Our guest today is the Reverend Al Sharpton. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to New Mexico.
Thank you, Lorraine. Glad to be here.
Well, we're really happy to have you here. You're going to speak to a joint session of the New Mexico Legislature. The House and Senate will meet and hear you speak. And I want to give a little about your background. You are certainly an iconic civil rights leader. You're also a Baptist minister. You have a national radio show called Keeping It Real with Al Sharpton. And you started, how many years ago? 5 years ago, the National Action Network?
Yeah, well, 20 years ago now.
Oh,
I started
20.
The radio show.
The radio
five
is
years
five,
ago.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and that's a civil rights organization. You've been really in the, wherever there is unrest and discord, you bring a perspective and you remind us of your teacher, your mentor, and the works of Martin Luther King. So thank you for all you do.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here and glad to be in Santa Fe for Black History Month and for several of the occasions with our friends in labor that work with us in National Action Network.
Right, right. Let's talk a little about your background. It's fascinating. You started preaching at 4 years old.
Yes, I was 4 years old and a member of the Pentecostal Church, Churches of God in Christ, and a member of the Junior Ushers. And we were getting ready to have a program, and they asked all of the kids what they wanted to do, and I wanted to preach, and they let me preach, and I started a series of sermons, and I became known as the Wonder Boy Preacher, and they ordained me when I was 9.
Wow. Wow. And then the other thing you did was extraordinary. At 14, you worked with Operation Breadbasket with Jesse Jackson.
Yes. When I was 13, I had met Dr. King a couple of times. And I was 13 when he was killed, and it really kind of shook me, and I believe brought me to my life's calling, and I decided to join Operation Breadbasket. At 13, I was a young minister, just entering my teens, and Reverend William Jones headed Operation Breadbasket in New York, nationally Reverend Jackson, and they appointed me youth director, and I was mentored directly by them from my teen years.
Well, you've said that really everything in your life, you haven't done anything else in your life but that isn't preaching or activism.
Right.
And so what brings you here?
Well, what brings me here is I'm very concerned about what we're doing in the country given the economic meltdown and the recovery. And what concerns me is that we seem to be scapegoating working class people. Like they are the ones that caused the meltdown. I mean, it has now been reported by a federal commission that the meltdown was caused by the government regulators looking the other way and the greed on Wall Street. But yet, when we hear about these deficits around the country, $400 million deficit in New Mexico, we are balancing the budgets and trying to bring down the deficits by penalizing workers, saying that we've got to increase their pensions and we've got to freeze workers and we've got to lay them off. It seems to me that we're trying to charge the tab of the recession and the meltdown to the people that didn't enjoy the party. And I think it's unfair. I think the scapegoating is unfair. And I'm on a national tour to say we've got to have some balance and a step back before we have the wrong people that are already suffer more for conditions they didn't cause.
And you wrote a piece, I think, in the Huffington Post called Paying for the Crimes They Didn't Commit.
Correct. I think that the piece I wrote in the Huffington Post, and really wrote it in light of my visit here, was to say that we cannot charge the wrong people for the economic down curve. Let's look at the fact now, Lorene, that Dow Jones has been over 12,000. So the Wall Street is back. Private sector is back. And we're going to now penalize workers who didn't cause the downturn, as I've said, while they are now enjoying all the perks and the vacations and the private jets and all of that. And the workers that didn't cause any of the problems are now going to pay the tab for the party they never enjoyed. It's not fair. It's not right.
But why is there a lack of alternatives? Why is that the default position of these municipalities and state governments looking at the budgets? Why do they first go to the workers? Why don't they first go to increasing taxes on the rich? Why hasn't that worked nationally or locally?
I think because there hasn't been the pushback and there hasn't been the mobilization to say to them, wait, we're not going to allow that. I think the pushback has come from the other side, the right wing, and not from the more progressive and more middle American forces that will say, why are we penalizing the people that can least afford it? And I think that's what we must do. You know, even if you change the pension setup, that won't cover the deficit. If you charge people more for their pension workers, that won't cover one dime in the $400 million deficit in New Mexico. So it's really smoke and mirrors to demonize and penalize the wrong people, and it doesn't even solve the problem.
Well, there's the issue of the living wage, because in so many states and here also, a person can work full-time and still qualify for its food stamps.
Right.
And so what is the relationship really between civil rights and labor?
They are very close because, first of all, people have the right to be paid for the work they do. That's a civil right. Secondly, the civil rights movement and the labor movement always worked hand in glove. The country celebrates Dr. Martin Luther King, who was my hero. And let's not forget, when Martin Luther King made that famous speech, I Have a Dream, that was at a labor march. A. Philip Randolph and Walter Ruther called that march. Dr. King was one of the organizers and a featured speaker, but labor mobilized the march. Dr. King was killed in Memphis going down supporting a strike by AFSCME, the union AFSCME. So civil rights and labor movement has always walked hand in hand, and we've got to come back together now, which is what we're trying to do, starting with this trip to New Mexico.
The most iconic image to me, there were many. Of course, there's the famous picture of the pointing on the balcony after King was shot.
Right.
But there's also the hundreds of workers with the sign that said, I am a man. And that says it all right there. This is about human dignity.
This is about human dignity, and it was about livable wages. That's what I am a man is. Pay me like I'm a human being. I am a human being. I am a man. Give me a livable wage. So you can, at one hand, celebrate Dr. King and human rights and then turn around and say, but we don't want livable wages. You can't love America and hate Americans. And I think that that's what we've got to do. We've got to not only love America. Real patriots love America and love Americans at the same time.
So while you've been in New Mexico, you've met with some union groups, and we're down at the University of New Mexico. So what is the response to your message here?
It has been very supportive, overwhelmingly supportive. Students who are now facing higher tuition threats and who are worried about their future. We met with them. I spoke at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. We had a standing only crowd. I met with labor leaders. I met with clergy. I met this morning with the mayor of Santa Fe. People understand it, and I think they've been waiting for people to call them to action. So National Action Network and AFSCME and other unions and I are putting together a national move. It's time for us to get back out. Last year, we saw the Tea Party mobilize. This year, we must mobilize working class people across party lines to say, wait a minute, we can't be scapegoated.
Well, the mood of the country, you know, the 60s when Martin Luther King did such wonderful work. There was a national movement that brought sexual revolution, the anti-war movement, the environmental movement, all of that was going on. Now the mood in the country and the sort of the timbre, even of the workers, seems to be ramped down. I mean, what will get people? Do we have to wait till there's so much suffering that people will finally?
I think Lorene, that people will respond if there's a call. And I don't think that we've made the call. I think people are ready. You're right. The civil rights movement of the 60s helped to energize the women's rights movement,
yeah,
the environmental movement, gay and lesbian movement, all of those movements. And I think a workers' movement now, livable wage movement now, will galvanize everyone. We cannot afford, after so much progress, to see people turn back the clock. We're not going back to pre-1940s America.
But the economy is such, and the competition for the few jobs there are is such, that it seems like the employers have almost the upper hand, because when people haven't worked for so many years, the unemployment situation being so dire, then they're willing, you know, people are willing to take less than they deserve.
If they are made to believe that's all they can get, they take it. But if you re-energize and reignite that hope, and say to people like they said in that graphic photo you referred to, I am a man, it will bring back a sense of dignity. It will make people lift their heads up and say, I just don't have to accept the crumbs off the table while you enjoy whatever you want. We need to have a country where we democratize where we are. So the bad news is that there are few jobs and we have an economy that's in a real tenuous situation. The good news is that in that situation, it gives us an opportunity to reorganize the economy where it's more fair to the average American person.
And the disparity between the haves and the have-nots has been getting greater and greater. You know, the rich have so much and the poor have so little. You know, that there have been revolutions throughout history because of that disparity. Not that a revolution is being called for, but something has to tip the status quo.
And something has to stand and say we at least have to have a sane conversation. If you're going to talk about covering deficits, if you're going to talk about the recession, you can't talk about sacrifice only from the workers and not sacrifices from those that caused it and that are making huge money again. And I think that if nothing else, we've got to change the tone in the country so we have a civil conversation with equal sacrifice, not sacrifice with people that have to get up every day that are the firemen, that are the policemen, that are the teachers, that are the laborers, work hard every day while others say, now the economy's back, I can go lay on my private yacht and while you take a pay cut or a job freeze. That is not the America that we all fought to maintain.
And in 1968 in Memphis, it was the sanitation workers, the workers that had to do the dirtiest work of our society, that were finally saying, I can't live on this. You know, you must treat me like a human.
There were the sanitation workers that wanted wages, treat me like a human. And two of them had been killed, which is what caused the strike, which is because there wasn't even the regard for their humanity to give them safety in the work condition. So why are we treating people like they're less than human? That was the fight in 68 that Dr. King died fighting for. He died organizing a poor people's campaign of blacks, of whites, of Latinos, of Native Americans. We need to pick up that banner today.
And also, I think that people, you know, there's a line, we learn from history that we don't learn from history. And I think that I'm happy to see the university students coming out for you, because people forget what unions have brought. We have weekends. We have safety rules. We have child labor laws. We have all the stuff that the unions have brought us.
I think you're right. And I think that it's important that we teach this to a new generation, show the need of that, because in the absence of that information and being drowned out by the media being dominated by forces that have really not given the whole picture, people don't understand, and they consider labor and civil rights groups to be obstructionists than the ones that really opened America up. That's because we've allowed them to run the narrative in this country, and we're not going to allow that anymore.
And when you ran for president in 2004, one of the things that you had said was that you want to change the discourse. You want to be asking different questions than everyone else was asking.
And that's why I ran. That's correct.
Exactly. So how do you see things in our national politics?
I think we changed a lot of the discourse, and I think that helped to elect President Obama in 2008. But I think that the other forces came back with a vengeance against him in 2010 and picked up a lot of seats. We've got to fight back. We cannot be intimidated. We cannot run. We've got to stand up for the good of all Americans.
I just want to shift our focus a little bit to the international stage, because we've all been watching what's happening in Egypt.
Yes.
And tell me, what do you see when you watch what's happening
there? You
know,
it is something that is riveting. And one of the things that was amazing about Tunisia than Egypt is these were mostly nonviolent marches. In fact, the tactics came straight out of Dr. King's and Gandhi's teachings. And the government responded like the Bull Connors of the 60s. They came in, started violent clashes, started intimidating, and the people refused to stand back. I think that it is a glorious time to watch people rise up against monarchs, rise up against oppression, and our children can watch in their living room, on their iPods, on their iPhones, the power of people standing up. For many years, as I had continued marching for civil rights and immigration rights and labor rights, people would say to me, does marching make a difference? Well, look at Cairo. Look at Tunisia. No one is asking that question today.
Well, we've almost run out of time, but I would like to know, what is your message? You're here in New Mexico. What would you like New Mexicans to know?
I'd like New Mexicans to know that we have become a country that has made great strides. We've made great progress, but we cannot at this peak in history turn around and demonize working class people. We cannot balance our books on the backs of those that cleaned the hospital beds and did the work and made these cities function. We cannot turn around and forget those that make America work and run every day. And we're going to stand up and say to those barons of industry, you caused the meltdown. Don't blame it on those that made America what America is.
Well, well said. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be with you.
Well, our first guest today is the Reverend Al Sharpton. It's been a very pleasure to have you here.
It's been my pleasure.
And now we're joined by a national figure, Lee Saunders, who is the Secretary Treasurer of AFSCME, which is the American, well, I'm going to let him tell us that in a minute, which is a subsection of the AFL-CIO. And I just want to welcome you here, Mr. Saunders. Thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, we, with Reverend Sharpton, raised some questions about what's happening in this economy and with the workers. And so, please, this is why we've asked you to come here, to give us a national perspective. You travel from state to state. You see what's going on. Tell me what's happening with the national economy and with workers, and please spell out what AFSCME stands
for.
Okay,
I'll be glad to. AFSCME is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent 1.6 million members across the country in state and local governments, nonprofit sector. The occupations range from nurses to childcare workers, sanitation workers, all occupations within state government, highway workers, schools. And so we have a wide variety of occupational groupings within our union. We're the largest union within the AFL-CIO, and we're one of the most politically active unions within the AFL-CIO. We are under tremendous attack. A tremendous attack right now, not only AFSCME, but the entire labor movement, because the right wing, the ultra-conservatives, have decided that they're making us the enemy, and they're saying that we are the cause, workers are the cause for the economic downturn in this country, which is not true at all. It's a lie. It's misinformation. Everyone knows that the problem started in Wall Street and the practices of Wall Street and the greed in Wall Street, yet people are trying to blame us and blame especially the public sector worker and saying that we are not sacrificing and therefore our pensions, our wages are under attack. The labor unions, civil rights organizations, faith-based organizations, student groups, we believe that we've got to all come together as one and fight this attempt to demonize essentially workers in this country.
Well, we just spoke with Reverend Sharpton, and he had written a piece called Paying for the Crime They Didn't Commit. And so why there does seem to be a leap of logic here, that if you got the workers who haven't changed at all and certainly haven't profited in any way, if anything, so many workers are actually working full-time jobs and still qualify for food stamps. And yet the rich are getting so much richer, the Wall Street executives, the corporate presidents, the disparity between the haves and the have-not is so great. How will your work affect that?
Well, the disparity is growing. And just let me give you some examples of how it is growing. Over the past 3 years, the top 1% of wage earners, those making millions of dollars and billions of dollars, they have seen their compensation increase threefold over the last 3 years. Their compensation has increased threefold. Now, they're already millionaires and billionaires, but they've seen that kind of increase. If you look at the average workers in this country, their average wages have actually declined. And there's something wrong. There's something wrong with that picture.
Well, it seems to me not only do you have to say enough is enough, but somehow an alternative has to be presented. Mm-hmm. You cannot balance the budget, the deficits that so many states are facing, on the backs of the workers.
No,
just
can't.
The money isn't there. I mean, just actually economically. Now, you're a labor economist. You know about these things. So what alternative then do you want to posit to these states and the municipalities who are, you know, running these huge shortfalls and deficits?
Well, first of all, you can't cut yourself out of this problem, out of this dilemma. And we are the first to say that many states and local governments across this country are experiencing severe economic difficulty. And we want to be at the table to sit down with the employer, with the politicians, and talk about solutions to these kinds of problems. But our first point is that you can't cut enough to resolve these problems. You've got to look creatively at increasing revenue and increasing taxes. Now, let me give you a point. It's something happening here in New Mexico. Millionaires in this state pay the same tax rate as those making $16,000 a year. And I think that's wrong. I mean, and that's not right. And so I think we've got to creatively look at the way we raise revenues, not to negatively impact on working families in the middle class, but expect that those who can afford to pay, they need to be paying their fair share.
We're almost out of time. If you could just give me your message for New Mexicans.
My message is that I think that all of us, labor, the civil rights community, faith-based groups, students, working people in New Mexico must get together, and we must develop a strong coalition to fight these attempts to really turn back the hands of time, to really turn back to the point where folks are not making a decent wage to feed their families or to send their kids through school. We have got to form a coalition. We've got to be very, very vocal. We've got to educate. We've got to mobilize. And we've got to convince those politicians that they have to be with us.
Well said. Thank you very much. Our second guest is Mr. Lee Saunders, who is the National Secretary Treasurer for AFSCME. Thank you for joining us. I also want to thank our former guest, our previous guest, the Reverend Al Sharpton. You both are here in New Mexico spreading the word.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Lorene Mills, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. We're going to take a break now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. Our guest today is Gunter Pauli. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you are here because you've written an extraordinary new book about which we will speak in a minute, but it's called The Blue Economy. And tell us the subtitle.
Well, the subtitle is very simple, 100 innovations that in 10 years will generate 100 million jobs.
Whoa. But first, let's start with your background. You're Belgian, and you years ago started a really groundbreaking company called Ecovere.
That's right.
So tell us a little about why your company was so different from everyone else and why it was needed so badly.
Well, you know, we had these amazing experiences in Europe where rivers started to look like huge soap fields. I mean, the foam was just growing and growing and growing, and we realized that we were using soaps that did a good job in cleaning, but they were not easy biodegradable. That meant they kept on cleaning the fishes and the frogs for weeks to go, and as a result there was a need to bring in a new product, a biodegradable product. And so I had no background in chemistry, I had no background in fast moving consumer goods, but I said I'm going to bring a product on the market that will be at least 1,000 times more biodegradable than the standard today. And I want to not only have a biodegradable product, I want it to be manufactured in a factory that is biodegradable itself. So at the end of its life, you could take it apart and do something else with it. And so we did. And we took 3% of the market without advertising. I was paying my workers $0.50 a mile to ride the bicycle to work. All my car fleet of the company in 91 was running on biofuels. So we're a bit ahead of our times.
Yes.
But then when I went to Indonesia to look at our suppliers in 93, I realized that I was responsible for the destruction of the rainforest.
Because in trying to use biodegradable products, you were using palm oil, and then what happened?
And so the palm oil, I was using a palm oil, our market share was growing, we needed more palm oil, and our suppliers, when we met them, said, you know, we're going to tear down about 800,000 hectares of rainforest in order to supply you and your future competitors biodegradable soaps. And then I realized that biodegradability is not the same as sustainability.
And so when they plowed down their old growth forests, they destroyed the habitat for the orangutan.
All of that.
And other unforeseen consequences. As Gore Vidal says, no good deed goes unpunished. You were...
Exactly. So it is, I had the best of intentions in the world, but I did not make the connection. I did not see the unintended consequences. And that is what made me think about the next business model. Because I had created by then already six enterprises. So, entrepreneur at heart, quite successful in the business, I said, but these business models are not going to do the contribution to our societies, our communities, and our earth the way we should do it.
Well, one thing about the soap that most people don't realize is that a third of the toxic pollution in a normal home is from the cleaning products.
Because we want to kill all the bugs, and we change the tension of the water. Now, when you change the tension of the water, then molecules can start moving over your skin and in your skin much faster than you could ever see it. Never imagine it. And so what is happening is we're changing the physics of our environment. And if we change the physics, we're changing the base conditions of life.
Well, I want to bring it up to the current situation with the big oil spill, because most people use regular detergents, which are a petroleum product, to get the petroleum, the oil, off these poor birds. What did you do about that?
Well, we got an award in 93 for having special soaps developed for the birds that are covered with oil slick. And because when you cleanse the bird with these quite effective but rather aggressive soaps, you're actually taking all the wax of the bird. And when the bird goes next time into water, bloom, dies. Because from coldness, from water penetrating up to the skin, normally they're fully covered against, they're beautifully waxed. So we developed a special soap that was made out of sugars. Alkyl polyglucoses for the experts, APGs. And so we made these, and so we could take off the slick, the oil slick, and we leave the wax on. And that was one of the products I had wanted to introduce, but faith decided differently.
Well, you talk about the natural world, and in this book there are so many wonderful ideas, brilliant ideas that are found in nature that people have been able to extend into commercial and humanitarian uses. For example, the question about mosquito bites. How come you always feel an injection, but you don't feel it when the mosquito is biting you?
Exactly.
What about this Japanese scientist?
Well, the beauty is that the Japanese ask themselves, how come this simple mosquito is always disliked by everyone for their biting, but something is happening there that we really should know about. And what we have looked at that case and the other 90 cases in the book is that nature knows how to use physics. It is the geometrical shape of the proboscis that allows it to have, with its conical shape, a no-pain entry into the skin. Today, all the needles for diabetes patients in Japan are shaped according to
The mosquito proboscis. Yeah.
And it's fantastic. I mean, everyone is scared to get a little shot, and the first time it's very scary, it's traumatic for a kid. But hey, just borrowing that physical shape of a cone versus a cylinder allows you to be able to have the needed medicine without pain.
I love these examples so much. If we could just talk about a couple more. The bombardier beetle.
Oh, yes.
That propels its toxic fumes at its enemy, the ants.
I mean, beating a colony of ants, you got to be smart to be able to do that. I mean, it's just not given to anyone. And so it has this capacity, again, with pure physical forces, to propel a gas over the ants at 10 times its own distance. Now, it's a tiny little animal. It's a tiny little insect. But to propel a gas coming out of its guts, I mean, I tell you, you talk to kids about it, they get excited. They want to know how this works. And of course, it reminds them of other things human beings sometimes do when they get too much gas in their intestines. But the beauty of it is that this is now going to be translated into a new mechanism for asthma patients to be able to disperse into their lungs what before needed chemicals. So we're substituting the chemistry that actually was damaging the environment, mm-hmm. the ozone layer. That chemistry is being replaced by a pure physical formula coming from a little beetle that needs to defend itself against ants.
Now, from the little beetle to the gigantic whale, what have we learned from whales, particularly their heart and their ability to create electricity from just potassium, sodium, and chloride?
Exactly. But the most important thing with a whale is that the whale used to be a dog. And the whale went back to the ocean and turned into this huge animal that's 1,000 times bigger than the dog. Now, we got to remind us that the size and the shape and the form is all the same for the dog and the whale, but 1,000 times bigger. That means that the whale had to secure conductivity of the electric current that is generated 1,000 times faster. And that meant it had to get superconductive systems around its heart. And it did it by developing very simple cells. Now that is giving us the idea on how to replace the pacemaker. So the pacemaker is basically an irregular current, an irregular heartbeat that is then actually caused by heart tissue that is not conductive. So the scientists who've been studying the whale now make little carbon tubes very similar to the tubes that the whale has made and place them from a part of the tissue of the heart that is very conductive to that part of the heart that is not conductive, and we can put the regular beat in motion again. And you know what? No batteries are needed. We eliminate the surgery, we eliminate the battery, we eliminate the trauma, and now with a simple catheter, it can be placed right into the heart, and the whale is the one that gave us the recipe.
A couple more, because these are enchanting. The penguins.
Well, you know, the penguins are the ones who are teaching us how to desalinate water. And they have these special glands underneath their eyes. And these glands allow them to actually take salty water in the Antarctic and then just sneeze and the salt comes out. I mean, they have this incredible capacity to let it go through a little membrane, sneeze. Sneezes basically means put pressure on there. It's again a purely physical effect. I mean, it's like reverse osmosis, where we have a membrane and then we have to put on high pressure. Now, we need huge installations that cost a lot of money for it. The penguin does it simply by sneezing.
In the sea world, the chambered nautilus.
Yeah.
Seaweed. I mean, there's so many things. Is there one or two more that you are fond of?
You know, I think one of the greatest ones is something that you've seen the mountains all the time, the river. Rivers, when we throw some dirt in the river, somehow the river succeeds in cleansing it a couple of miles downstream. And scientists realize there's some very simple movement that is always being generated, the vortex.
Vortex.
And this vortex allows to take air out, and this vortex allows to put air in. Now, when you take air out of the water and you put air into the water, then you're promoting different type of bacteria. You're promoting the aerobes and the anaerobes. And so the anaerobes and the aerobes are stressed all the time. And so whatever there is as biological waste or even chemical waste, they just eat it. They just clean it up. Now, what is this useful for? First of all, we now have the first ice rink in America, in Telluride, that is going to be equipped with a vortex. And the vortex is going to take all the air out of the water. And as a result, they save 100,000 kilowatt hours of electricity because it needs less energy to make the ice and keep the ice. But better even, now you can see straight through the ice. Straight through, so the advertising remains visible. So now you have a new business model emerging, and that's what we want to do. We want to have an economy with a new business model. Instead of saying to the city of Telluride, you got to pay for this machine, pay back maybe a month, but now we say to the advertiser, your advertising, your logo is going to be visible much longer. You got to pay more per second of contact over TV to the audience that wants to see the hockey game. And therefore, you should install this. So the city gets it for free. saving money. And the advertiser gets better visibility for the logo. And as a result, win, 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 win. And what are we doing? We're just borrowing from the way a river works.
Well, I want to come back to your book, because anyone who's been entranced by these stories has to know there are so many more in here. But this book was originally written as a report to the Club of Rome. And the Club of Rome is, you can talk about it a little bit, but I want to mention that in 1972, the Club of Rome produced the best-selling environmental book in the history of the world, The Limits to Growth. And
correct.
Now I'm hoping the same for your book.
Well, thank you.
Tell us about the Club of Rome and what your mission is in a book like this.
Well, the Club of Rome was a group of top-notch politicians, very well-placed business people, scholars, scientists, members of academies.
World leaders,
sciences.
Mikhail Gorbachev, Trudeau of Canada.
That's right. So they got together and they said, the way the world is going, it seems to be doing good, but we're going to hit a brick wall sometime soon. We have to make connections amongst our industrial growth, our population growth, our consumption of energy, our environmental pollution, and our health conditions. And there was Jay Forrester at MIT who developed a very special software program, Systems Dynamics, and that they were able to see for the first time what happens if we continue on this growth path and the pollution and the health and the So they put it into a complex analysis, and they said there are limits to growth with a model that was used in the 60s. So I, in the 70s, was a leader of the students in Belgium. And as a student leader, it was the 70s, not the 60s anymore. So I wasn't there anymore being against everything and wanted to, you know, just retire in India. I wanted to be the new kind of entrepreneur and business person. I didn't want to go and work for the big companies. I wanted to be the one creating new business models, very much influenced by the Club of Rome. Because the president of the Club of Rome was the president of Fiat and Olivetti, two huge companies in those days in Europe. So what I want to do with the book is that we have seen for years the bad news. It keeps on coming at us. And I said, no, we will have to inspire young people to be able to imagine a much better world as entrepreneurs. And I don't make a distinction between the social entrepreneur and the business entrepreneur, because whatever entrepreneurship is about, it has to include social and ecological from day one. How could you do something that is not social and ecological at the same time while making money? And so I needed to think about, how do we redefine competitiveness? How do we have a business model whereby we're not asking consumers to pay more to be green, where we're not asking angel investors to take lower returns because it's green, where we're not asking the government to pay subsidies and increase taxes so we can live environmental. I'm saying, let's embrace the innovations that have been benchmarked and that are known, and let's just expose these innovations to millions of young people around the world, and they will create the new business models. And that's what we want to do.
Well, there's a whole lot of, I have actually some vocabulary questions. Why is this the blue economy? Why is it not the green economy?
Because the earth is blue. You look at this beautiful earth from the outside in the universe, she is blue. The blue sky, the blue ocean. I mean, green refers to chlorophyll, and that's the trees. Now, a lot of people have done a lot of great work to get the green economy going. But if you ask people to pay more and investors to get less return, it's going to remain a fringe. You have to embrace a new business model. So what we're saying, for example, in the book is, instead of going from a toxic battery to a green battery, we say no battery.
Yeah.
So if you say no battery, you've changed the business model. That means your cell phone, your MP3 player, your pacemaker, all of that without a battery. Now, if we don't have the battery, we don't have the smelting, we don't have the mining, and we don't have the recycling anymore. Now, recycling is expensive. We know we got to do it. But what if we all have cell phones without batteries? And the first one is already working for 7 months in Germany, and it works with our body heat, and it works with the pressure of our voice. When I'm speaking into this microphone, I'm exerting a pressure, and that pressure is converted to electricity. It's called piezo electricity. Now, that electricity today is commercially viable for a cell phone. Now, not only are we now saving the battery, we don't need chargers anymore. We lose all the time our chargers somewhere in the world. So we don't have to buy a second charger. We don't need a charger in our car anymore. So we're getting rid of all the paraphernalia around that cell phone. We keep it simple. Now, that is what natural systems teach us. Keep it simple. If you keep it simple, you're more competitive. If you're more competitive, then you are more innovative.
Well, you come to Santa Fe to speak for the Permaculture Credit Union's 10th year anniversary, and you come just having met with some of the most extraordinary minds of our time. Who did you see in San Francisco?
Well, the book launch in San Francisco was together with Fritjof Capra, the author of the Tao of Physics.
The Tao of Physics. And you just were at the Rocky Mountain Institute with...
Yeah, Amory Lovins invited me to talk to all his staff and bring the somewhat crazy and out-of-the-box ideas, but a third of them in the book have been benchmarked. A third of them we can say, if you don't believe we can regenerate a rainforest from a savanna that was destroyed by cattle farming over decades, come and see, we got the project. It's running, it's doing well, it's generating jobs, it is actually providing drinking water, it's generating the fuels we need. And this is not a bunch of hippies getting together. This is about people dedicated to have a future for their kids. It is about what can we do to secure that we respond to the basic needs of all on this earth with what we have. And that is perhaps the most important thing. There's so much we do, so much we want to do, Lorraine, with what we don't have. So we're saying, let's be inspired with what we have. And it's all around us. We just got to be inspired.
Is that sustainability?
For me, that is exactly sustainability. Sustainability is the capacity to respond to the basic needs of all with what you have. Now, in natural systems, if we look at evolution, everything goes from scarcity to abundance. This is fantastic. This is paradise that is always organized. Even in the Namib Desert, there is abundance for the lichens. They have abundance. And abundance is achieved by having more diversity. Now, that is the key. We get more diversity. Now, who brings diversity? Well, entrepreneurs can do that. You can use that same technology of the vortex and apply it in 37 different areas. You start with 37 businesses. Now, therefore, we need the next generation of entrepreneurs.
Well, you are the founder and director of something called ZERI, Z-E-R-I. Yeah. Tell us about it, please.
Well, in 1991, just when I started my factory, I wrote an article saying we have to go for zero waste and zero emissions. We're the only species on Earth capable of making something no one desires, waste. We waste waste. In natural systems, whatever is waste for one is nutrient for someone else. So I said we have to design business models that has no more waste, no more emissions. In 1994, when I had sold my business to my partner in Belgium, then the Japanese government was getting ready for the Kyoto Protocol. And the Japanese government said, we need an entrepreneurial mind to lead a team of scientists to design the business model that has zero waste and zero emissions. And I was the lucky one, and I was invited to come to Japan and had a team of 82 academics, not being an academic myself. And that gave me such an exposure to the opportunities to say, well, if we want to rethink mining, how could we do mining without emissions? And of course, 81 of the professors would say, not possible. I only needed one who said, I got an idea. Uh-huh. And I would say, focus. What can we do to make your idea benchmarked, tested? And so today in the book, we have the first technologies where we see how we can take 400 million tons of e-waste, all the old computers and electronics that we have, we crush it into dust. And with a simple film, we can go through it and we take out all the metals one by one at ambient temperature and pressure. And that technology is inspired how bacteria have been focusing on very specific metals they need to be able to live. We also need iron, and we need a little bit of copper, and so we have a symbiosis with those species who teaches us how to get the copper out and the iron out. Now, that is now put on a film, and you can just go through it and take it up. So, For 3 years, I was exposed to one idea after the other, and the scientists kept on providing. So in 96, when we were getting ready for Kyoto, I decided to put all the knowledge, with the support of the Japanese government and the United Nations, into a foundation called Zero Emissions Research and Initiatives. Because we were not ready to just do the research, we wanted to implement.
One of the things, as you talk about this kind of cascading systems design, which is that you have a system input here, the output is waste, but that is then the input for another system. That's the raw material. And
exactly.
Then the output, the waste output of that is raw material for yet another. It's a magnificent model.
Well, everyone is doing it around the world. Every living critter on this earth is doing it, except one.
Yeah.
Us. But we can learn. If I have my cup of coffee, and I know that 99.8% of my coffee is wasted, because I will only ingest 0.2%, then I know I can press that coffee waste together, I can inoculate it with shiitake, and I can farm shiitake. And then when I've harvested the shiitake...
Those are mushrooms. Yeah.
There's a mushroom, a very healthy mushroom. Now, that shiitake leaves waste behind. And that waste is rich, so rich in amino acids, that we can take something that you could never have fed to the chickens or the pigs, you can now feed it to your pigs. And so we have coffee, we have mushrooms, and we have animal feed. Three cash flows.
Yes, yes.
And we thought it was waste. And so we said we can do that with our biological wastes. But let's take now a bottle, a glass bottle. We know we have done so much to try to recycle bottles. But turning a bottle back into a bottle is like asking a tree to take the leaves from the fall and put them back on in the spring. Doesn't work. It's too expensive. So we have been trying to make bottles out of bottles, and that's too expensive. So without taxation, it doesn't work. And I don't like taxes. We are all happy to pay a little bit of taxes to contribute to our communities, but we're not willing to be taxed to death. So what I'm saying is that, well, if you take now the glass bottles, you crush them, you inject it with CO2, then you make a building material. And that building material is better than steel and reinforced concrete. And that building material is actually inspired by the multifunctionality of nature. In nature, everything has multiple functions. Nothing is done for one purpose only. And so when you have that glass foam with CO2 embedded in it, you can actually build with it. It is an insulation material. No rats will go through it. No molds will ever grow in it. And no water will come through. So I got five functions in one product.
We're almost out of time. And one of the most wonderful things you do, and we could talk for so long, your work with Gunter's Fables and with children, because as Dr. Goodall does, Jane Goodall, with her Roots and Shoots, her outreach into the young people to teach them new ways of thinking and to empower them. What are you doing with young people?
Well, having kids myself, I just wonder how can I bring that whole body of knowledge to kids. And they don't have to wait till they're 18 or 20 to read a book that's a bit too scientific for them. So the only way that I could do it is tell them stories, fables. So I wrote 36 fables, and these 36 fables bring 1,500 scientific subjects to the kids without talking science. And they will know and understand, why does a zebra have black and white stripes? How does the water get in the coconut? I mean, no one is pumping the water up into the coconut. And the apple falls down from the tree, but the apple had to get up in the tree before it could subject itself to the law of gravity. And they don't teach it in school. So bringing that body of questions, not answers, body of questions to the kids, and give them hints through illustrations, through some words that we play with, the kids start imagining, and they find the solutions.
Well, I you have sparked my imagination so much. I want to show this book again, the Blue Economy. I think that people will have just their minds opened up when they look at all the possibilities that you've set forth there. I'd like to thank our guest today, Gunter Pauli. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.